This is Gaten the Mecha, the weekly anime and manga show where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from arcs to OPs to episodes in my wacky but enjoyable quest to make sense of all of it. Welcome back to Gaten the Mecha. I'm your host Jamal today, and in today's episode, I bring you something that I didn't ever think I was ever going to do, and that is a look at my One Piece journey so far. If you have been listening very closely to the podcast, you would know that I've established quite firmly that I would never get into One Piece, but after a very tempting secondhand offer and the popular pressure to start reading the manga, I have finally decided to take the plunge. And so over the past week and a half, if not 2 weeks, I've read about 200 chapters of the manga so far, and I'm going to be discussing that today. I'm going to be basically analyzing my thoughts and some of the things which I've observed as of lately. It's not really a theory thing or a review, more of just delving into some of the ideas and compressing that all into one episode. If you do enjoy this episode, feel free to leave the review, whether that's on Apple Podcasts or wherever you do get your podcasts. And without further ado, here is the episode for this week, that is episode 56 of Gaten the Mecha, a look into my One Piece journey. As always, before we get into the analysis, I will give you my alerts for this episode regarding spoilers and the rest of it. I have currently read 200 chapters of the manga at the moment, and that includes the entirety of the East Blue Saga, as well as the majority of the Alabasta Saga. I'm about 17 chapters away from finishing that. And so as a result, that will be a spoiler warning for the entirety of the East Blue Saga and the entirety of the Alabasta Saga. If you are unsure as to where the arcs are, be sure to check the arc list in the show notes on guestinthemecha.home.blog for this episode, and you can check that comes from the wiki. As I said earlier, how I got into One Piece was basically I was on eBay, I saw a really good offer for volumes 1 to 21, and that cost about, in my money, £55. I think that would be a bit higher in dollars, but about £55, which was really good. That takes me all the way to the middle of Alabasta, and then I decided to do a second order recently, which I didn't speak about in my last episode, where I ordered the 3-in-1 volumes all the way from the end of the Alabasta Saga, all the way to the end of Water 7 and the slight beginning of the Enies Lobby arc. I don't know whether I will be ordering things after this current... I don't know whether I'll be ordering anything physically after this order. I think I will probably end up reading digitally till the end, or maybe I will collect up to the end of the pre-time skip, but I'm not too sure at the moment. I think I am equipped to do some arc analyses and maybe some thematic analyses, but I still think the weird thing with One Piece is that a lot of the themes seem to compound over each other as you get further in. However, I am, relative to One Piece, quite not very far in, actually. I'm 2 sagas in versus the amount of sagas which they are. I still have about 4 sagas to go, I believe, within this part of it, being Sky Island, Water 7, Thriller Bark, and Summit War. So there's still much to do. There's still much work to do. And so the themes I'm going to discuss, I still think will take a lot of time to evolve, but I'm still comfortable talking about how I've encountered them, even if they're in their very miniature or early forms. I think it'll be very cumbersome to do an entire plot summary so far because we have 2 sagas to recap. And no, I'm not going to do that. You guys know, I'm assuming, if you are listening to this episode, I do also recommend checking the wiki and the arc list if you want your fill or recap as to what has happened so far. Essentially, the point I'm at is the Alabastan Revolution, or the Alabastan Rebellion, where there's still this belief that Cobra has been behind this entire scheme to starve some of the villages of rain. We've also assembled many members of the Straw Hats already, that is everyone from Zoro at Romance Dawn, Nami at Orange Town, Sanji at Barassi, and all the rest of them. We've even met Chopper as well at Drum Island, one of my personal favorite arcs so far. However, the main character I really want to zoom in on in today's episode is Luffy. I'm not going to do an entire character analysis, but I think there is a lot to learn and take from him as a character because he really does carry a lot of these themes. When I say carry, I don't mean it in the casual sense that, oh, he's the one making this show have some thematic sort of relevance or weight, but I more mean it in he represents a lot of these themes and he holds most of these themes very dear. I like to see Luffy as, it is an overall theme as I kind of mentioned or alluded to, but I like to think of Luffy as an idealist, mostly because of that very basic idealist idea, if you want to call it that, or idealist principle, that ideas transcend the physical, the material world. The main theme of the manga, which I seem to be guessing from it, is that taking control and ownership of one's ideals is infinitely better than holding on to the material, because the material is something which is limiting and also it's one which can fail us as people. We see that a lot in some of the later East Blue arcs like Arlong Park, and it's also a very prominent thing within Alabasta. This might sound like a bit of a reach or a stretch, but I like to think that Luffy even carries this within his own mannerisms, even on the physical level. The way he sort of ignores the danger of things when it comes to sitting on the edge of his own ship, or when he just sits on the railing of a random building without caring, or on the railing of a boat even. One thing that I really love is how he just loves to climb over fences and climb over walls. It's just that disregard for the physical, which I find really entertaining, but also it really kind of does exemplify that the ideal and the idea, which is friends, and the idea, which is ambition, is something which he holds a lot more dear than just the physical world in itself. I really loved that part in Baratie arc when he wakes up and instead of questioning where he is and everything and what usually people would do, if you take Shinji, he would say that I don't know the ceiling or the ceiling is unfamiliar. But then you look at someone like Luffy and he's like, my hat. So he's questioning where that is as opposed to where am I, and caring about his physical presence, because that isn't, and yes, you can say his hat is the material and a representation of that, but it's the idea that I think he holds more important than the physical hat, hence why he's able to take it off and the rest of it. Again, I don't want this to sound like some explained video, because it's not. I'm not trying to explain the logic of One Piece and the logic behind protecting his hat. I just find it funny how you can kind of, even on the smallest level, kind of still see how that idealist component is communicated. The material world and the material aspects of life are ones which can be seen as harmful, dangerous to the human character. I say human in a kind of weird sense, because not everyone in One Piece is human per se. We do have fishmen, if we take Arlong Park, but they still like to think, although they think of themselves as some sort of higher life form, and then we get into the whole debate on hierarchy and the rest of it. But when it comes to it, I don't know if I can't really say the life condition instead of the human condition, but you know what I'm trying to communicate is that the beings within One Piece do treasure the material quite a lot. Piracy is innately about collecting materials and the rest of it. It's about plundering for the sake of collecting things for your own interest. And that dependence on the material is something which is very prominent within East Blue. I really managed to get a sense of this during the Baratie arc, when Krieg shows off his armor and the rest of it. It's not necessarily done in the most subtle way, but nonetheless, the whole idea of flexing the material and stating that this is my strongest armor, nobody has beaten it, I am the greatest, it's that value or that emphasis on the material being more important than the ideal. An antagonist like Krieg within Baratie obviously doesn't make this any easier for himself, because while maintaining full faith or putting all his eggs within the material basket, I know I'm going to say material and physical a lot in this episode, but there is a lot of idealism to get into. But because he puts a lot of his eggs in the material basket, he also doesn't do any favors by violating the ideal or the idea being killing Gin, for example, or Jin, I believe it is in the Japanese. Violating the fabric which keeps them together, I think, is kind of mean. It looks very twisted, and I can understand why Luffy decided to dislike this, because not only does he have full faith in this, but he completely turns his back on ideals, because hard power, something, a theme which is very prominent within this. It's almost a realist versus idealist battle within One Piece, but that overconfidence and faith within hard power is completely opposed to the non-physical or non-material importance that is an idea or an ideal. There's a similar case within the Arlong Park arc within East Blue again as well. And this is the case with Nami when she puts an insane amount of faith within to currency, within to money, and then that can be taken away at the blink of an eye, whereas Luffy manages to prove to Nami that ideals are something which can be reignited. And still managing to get Coco Village back, that is the proof almost needed that the ideal transcends the material, and there is only so much that having that level of faith within the material world can do anyway. I think this realist versus idealist battle between the states and the pirates is an attempt to almost tear apart the idea of hard power and the flaws within hard power. You can say it's a criticism, but I don't know if it's a criticism. It at least shows its flaws, but I think often many do jump to the assumption that because something is showing its flaws, it's immediately an anti this. Good example, although I won't get too into it, is when I was reading about the Grave of Fireflies. Many do assume that the Grave of Fireflies is anti-war. And when reading into Takahata and the person that actually wrote the book, it's not necessarily that it's a anti-war or a criticism of war, but it's a criticism more of one of the characters within it itself. And I think that's a similar case with One Piece. It's not necessarily criticism of hard power and hard politics and realist politics, but it most definitely shows the limitations of it. I think a good example would be that the realist view of politics, or at least hard power itself and coercion and the rest of it, can be quite useful when we think of the Navy, although the Navy has flaws in itself, which is one of the funny parts of One Piece generally, but that is something which we'll eventually get to as I read on. I do think the conflict between hard power and idealism, or realism and idealism, really meets very well within the Drum Island arc. This is the epitome of a figurehead that believes he's a monarch for some reason and is driven by this sort of divine provenance to rule over Drum Island, and then someone, or the pirate crew, the Straw Hat crew, which is denying him of that. If we are to view this as demonstrating the flaws of hard power, you can say that it's rather disenfranchising for the people and it's negative for the people. Wapol as a character within Drum Island was almost centralizing essential services within to the state and using them for his own means, such as the quote-unquote 20 doctors, which I found really awful. It's interesting because you would suspect that one who has access to resources and the apparatus that the state has access to would use this positively. And then in reverse, characters who are pirates, who are often viewed as the negative ones, are really the ones who are doing the good stuff here versus those who are in places of high authority and in high importance who actually just abuse their power. A really good part in Alabasta for me was when, and I think it kind of just confirmed everything which I've been thinking about lately when it comes to idealism within politics, although I do need to brush up on idealism nonetheless, but I found it funny how Crocodile actually said the word idealism, and maybe it doesn't mean that much, but to me it was actually quite a big deal to note that Oda is consciously writing this. I'm not saying, oh, Oda doesn't know what idealism is. I'm sure he does, and he's a very smart writer from what it seems like, but it was really interesting how he kind of just confirmed my suspicions that, is this an idealist narrative? And then by Alabasta, Oda's just like, yes, Crocodile is critiquing idealism. Because I think sometimes idealism is brushed over as just having faith in an ideal or just thinking that everything is positive. Idealism most definitely is a optimistic philosophy. But there is a lot more depth than just simply holding an ideal. It's not just being positive and being within some sort of fantasy world. It goes into a lot of things which I'm not really ready or confident enough to discuss, but that is something which I definitely want to delve into a bit more as I get into One Piece, because it's really pushing this idea of idealism. I think quite a good thing is that, similarly to what I said, I don't remember when I did say this, but it was in relation to my slight criticism of My Hero at some points. And no, this isn't a big comparison, but sometimes I felt like My Hero was having these, and Overhaul did manage to question it, that we have these innate good and bads which aren't really questions, they just exist because that is all they know. And the bad will infinitely be the bad because that is those who are in positions of power, and the rest of it managed to establish that narrative. And although, yes, this was a critique to the logic of the show, Overhaul was saying that in the context of the show, I kind of feel like that was the case within the show generally, and it felt kind of weird to me. So that was something I brought up, but in the case of what I've been reading in One Piece so far, I would say that this idealist component, which has been pushed slowly but surely throughout East Blue and is really managing to gain traction within Alabasta, those feel like a good basis for an antagonism, and it's not an antagonism for the sake of it being there, because they're the bad guys. In a maybe usual situation, if you're just talking from a complete neutral perspective, I would most likely assume that the government is, its intention is to serve and do good, and the pirates are ones which mean to disrupt that. But interestingly, it's actually reversed, and it's then padded by this idealist realist or idealist hard power conflict, which I find quite good and justified. I kind of want to wrap up my discussion on the idealist ideas which seem to be coming from One Piece, because I could talk about that forever, and I do want to save some material, because who knows, I could be talking about some of my favorite arcs in the future. But so we can move on, I think there's a really good quote which comes from chapter 100 within the Logtown arc, and this was kind of the concluding means of the beginning. I find something that I really find funny before I get into the quote is that even though this is chapter 100, and in most manga, which are, I don't know, 400 chapters, 300 chapters, or something around that length, you would assume that, okay, this isn't necessarily the beginning. But in the case of One Piece, this is the beginning. You are 1/9, if not 1/10 into this narrative. And so it kind of really does feel like the prologue, which I find kind of funny. But into the quotes, which kind of sets things into motion after East Blue and when we're going onto the Grand Line. Things that cannot be stopped. Inherited will, a man's dream, and the flow of time. As long as a man continues to seek out the answer to freedom, these things shall never be stopped. And that comes from Pirate King G. Roger in chapter 100. Similarly to when I finished the war arc in the anime of Vinland Saga, it felt shocking when I found out that this was kind of only the prologue, this was only the base of the entire thing. And it made me feel really small, but also really excited that if this is just made to set everything in motion, then what will it really be like in motion itself? And I'm starting to experience that in Alabasta, and I can kind of see what people are talking about this being a slightly slow burner manga. But as it builds up and things manage to snowball, it really does manage to perform really well. If we are to view this as the prologue, and now that I've completed 100 more chapters after this, I think the East Blue Saga has done a really good job at least establishing the very basis of One Piece. It doesn't feel like it overstretches into these big subplots, because as I have experienced again from Alabasta and the rest of it, there are a lot of things which come together and go on throughout the entire thing, and the East Blue Saga, I wouldn't say is the most referenced thing now. There are most obviously relevant things, but it's not as if the East Blue Saga as of yet, from what I know, has things which are really important which you must remember for going into the later arcs and the rest of the narrative, besides maybe the core of it being the assembly of the Straw Hats, maybe the fishman existence, and then just the stuff at Romance Dawn. But it's good at establishing the sort of anarchic world that is One Piece. But one thing which really, it doesn't bother me, but it makes me feel really weird, and I'm still managing to sort of think about it and sleep on it. But it's how, despite living in this anarchic world, there is still a degree of hierarchy. Seeing anarchy and hierarchy not necessarily coexist, but yes, sort of coexist together. Two things in political thought which are, from what I understand of it, seem almost polar opposite or diametrically opposed. Seeing that together has a really interesting feel for its own world, because this is something I simply haven't seen before. But ironically, what you would expect to be a lot more chaotic, anarchy, is the thing which is actually combating hierarchy for better, maybe from my perspective anyway. This notion sort of bleeds into the Alabasta saga as well, with the existence of Crocodile having his position within the world government and basically being endorsed by it allows him to exploit the revolutionary conscience of those within Alabasta, or the rebels in particular. He also manages to abuse the natural state skepticism which is something which a realist would most definitely believe, but he manages to insert that seed within to the masses, and that causes this arguable inevitable revolution. I don't know if One Piece manages to tell us about the human condition per se, but it would be really interesting if it does. It most definitely shows us these opposed views of human nature, one which is boundlessly optimistic if you take Luffy and such, versus a very skeptical view which is humans are to be used and abused and can be used for my own interests, and it's that skepticism. Maybe I am thinking a bit too deep about this or too politically about this. Partially because I am reading One Piece a lot for its politics, because this is something which I find really interesting. And I haven't really found an anime or manga which I really get sucked into the politics of. With all of that being said, I would say that the real meat of the manga for me seems to be after the East Blue Saga, after the prologue, which is where this political layer kind of meets the personal layer, which is explored a lot more within the East Blue Saga. I think I'll briefly comment on structure a bit and say that I think One Piece is structured in a way which favors Oda when it comes to establishing and building and snowballing, if you want to call it that. I know snowballing is not a sort of meta literary criticism word. I don't even know if that made sense, but I know it's not that sort of thing, but hear me out a bit. The structure of the narrative or story being within sagas, we have the Rookie Saga and the New World Saga. New World I have not read, but those two big sagas, within those we have the sagas within the sagas, and then we have the arcs within the sagas. On the saga to saga level, at least from the data which I have at the moment, 200 chapters, which maybe isn't too much, nowhere even near halfway in, but it's really good at demonstrating the ideals of these characters. This is done through the flashbacks, and then when that is carried over to Alabasta, this is sort of put into action. Because we know these, if I go as far as saying character philosophies, these are put into context within combat situations and within political situations, such as handling the Alabasta Revolution or Rebellion, and even dealing with conflicts at Little Garden and all sorts of other stuff. Drum Island is also a good example. From the outside looking in, I did think that the saga structure was a bit absurd. I was initially confused as to why it existed. Why would, if you have arcs, have a whole massive saga already? And why would you have multiple sagas? Why didn't you have arcs rather than a saga to sum up or contain those arcs? But as I started to read, I started to realize why these structures exist, and that is to bounce off one another. Initially, when you start Alabasta, you think, okay, where is this going? We're on the Grand Line right now. Why is this called Alabasta? What is Alabasta? And then you kind of think for a bit at the beginning, say during Reverse Mountain, that Alabasta's maybe just because its last arc is called Alabasta, and then something will happen there. But as the name Alabasta, I'm going to say that a lot, but as the name manages to infiltrate the discussion of the show, or the manga, sorry, you slowly start to realize why these are all put together and contained together, because everything is made for this specific reason, and it shows that there's a lot of intentionality from Oda there. I think this is the reason why I want to keep up the momentum, and that's why I've ordered so many physicals. I don't know if I'm very proud of it, but it's because I think the momentum really comes from reading these sagas collectively. They are put together for a reason. I think it would be really dangerous for me personally if I was to take a break from One Piece to, I don't know, read another manga, say Monster, which I haven't managed to finish yet. I'm still on like the first 5 chapters. But if I'm to take a break and read something like Monster, or continue reading Berserk and the Conviction Arc, or something else which I haven't been reading lately, or Hunter x Hunter, which I took a break on lately. If I was to do that during the, say, Water 7 saga, take a break within Water 7, I'll feel really guilty that I didn't manage to at least get through Enies Lobby, just because they are there and they're supposed to be one after the other. They're supposed to bounce off one another. And so maybe I think the saga structure maybe is just keeping me hooked to the manga, but it's also a really effective way of understanding and navigating around One Piece. but that is enough on structure. I'm just going to go into some, not necessarily closing thoughts, but just some closing statements to think about before we end this episode. I'm not going to do an in-the-moment segment this week, just because this kind of felt like a massive in-the-moment segment already, talking about what I've been reading, and so kind of eschewing this episode to talking about another manga or anime, I feel would be a bit clunky and maybe distracts from my grand opening, which is me finally reading One Piece. But I'm just gonna sort of summarize slash talk about some things to just think about and take away. If I'm completely honest, I think I'm maybe analyzing One Piece a bit too politically. It is most definitely a political narrative, which I've sussed out almost as soon as I got into Alabasta, or my suspicions were confirmed by Drum Island slash the Alabasta arc. And I think my passion for political thought and philosophy and all of that, not in the humble brag sense, I just mean an interest within it, is maybe what is guiding my praise for it so far. Because there are so many political elements to analyze that I just want to get my teeth right sunk into it. But these are some questions which I think have really managed to come out, which I'll be thinking about over the next few weeks or months while I'm reading this. Questions like, what is the role of government or the state? What is the role of the state? One would say it's to serve its citizens and its citizenry, but some would say it's a means for power and driving one's own interests. Another would be, does liberation have a role in our politics? That's an interesting one, and Alabasta is managing to question that, but I think a better question would really be, as the arc itself has managed to question, is revolution inevitable when a population has been pushed to its maximum extent, when it's done with dealing with all this false consciousness and all those other sorts of things? Is there a point where revolution is inevitable and one must topple the system from above in order to reform it for those below? This is kind of also something similar to what I said about the role of the state. What is the role of authority, or more specifically, what is authority? Is authority innately corrupting? Is authority in adverse? We can also question whether state skepticism is necessary, and I would definitely say yes. This is the only question I'm going to answer, but yes, it is. But is it right, or not necessarily right, because that kind of sounds moral, but is it justified for the citizenry to care that much about the state's activities, or is the existence of the state in itself good enough? There's also something which I've heard, but I do want to say that I'm not really involved yet within the One Piece community, so I don't want to act like I've been listening to all the threads on Twitter and all the discussions and essays, because I haven't, honestly. But a big theme or discussion which I hear often is about freedom and liberation, and I'm not disagreeing with it. For now, what I've read doesn't really scream freedom and liberation too much. I would say that it is there, but I would say that there are other emphases which maybe take a bit more precedent over the freedom and liberation discussion or subtext. To what extent should the people be free from the state, and is the state a means of coercion on the people of said state or country? I'm only 2 sagas into the manga, and I still have many chapters and sagas and arcs to go, but regardless, I'm really excited to see how this will eventually evolve, and hopefully it evolves positively. Thank you for listening to this episode of Guest in the Mecha. That has been episode 56. Hopefully you did enjoy this episode. It's a bit of a slightly different format. More often than not, I like to finish something and then look back on it with hindsight, or just have everything in my head and then sort of segment my analyses. If you did enjoy this episode, it would be lovely if you left it a review. Every review helps, and it also helps others find this show as well. Have a great day, week, month. I've been saying month almost too often now, and I'm not going to say the 2020 joke because I know it's getting annoying, but I will be seeing you guys hopefully next week on episode 57. I have been your host, Jamal, today, and this has been Get in the Mecha. The music in this production goes as follows. 8-bit title screen by Joth, mandatory overtime by Joth, and difference by Chasers Gaming.